This episode is sponsored by Clinico. Clinico is practice management software that makes life easier for allied health professionals by handling appointment scheduling, storing treatment notes, hosting video consultations, and much more. The software is used globally by tens of thousands of practitioners every day. They are looking for a marketing designer and illustrator to join the team. Working closely with their marketing and content teams, you'll create work for both screen and print. They are hiring on Pocket Jobs, and the link to apply is in the show notes.
Everybody, welcome back to a brand new Techish, and we're reunited. It's Abadesi of Hustle Crew and
Michael reunited, and it feels so good. Whose song is that? I've forgotten who sings that. But anyways, yeah, I digress. We back. Let's get cracking with the first story, man. Should we move?
Whoop.
Cool. So Shopify has invested in Stripe. And you know what, it's not really much of a headline, but to me, it kind of irks me slightly because essentially Stripe has sold a large chunk of the company to like Stripe, to Shopify and a whole bunch of other VCs, but it's all shares in a secondary market. So it's for employees, other investors who have sold shares. And we talked about this a way back when where I'm like, why won't Stripe go public? Basically. So I'm kind of hating because I'm like, I want to get into this involved. Like, where's my taste? Like, I want to own some Stripe, and I think it's
tell me about
right,
it.
You know what I'm saying? As in ordinary investors, Joe Public, basically me and you can't get involved unless we've got some super connection to Stripe employees, which you kind of do, to be fair. But at the same time, it's very complicated legally to buy secondary shares. You can't just do it from the UK.
So hard.
Right.
Got to get them network effects as well. I don't know anybody who's going to be selling me some of their, no one's going to be giving away Stripe shares unless they're trying to like maybe get a ticket on Jeff's rocket. But anyway.
Yeah, but like, for example, I remember reading about how Gary Vee bought Facebook shares from like Mark Zuckerberg's auntie. Something crazy like that. And I'm like, how much of your wealth is just built up in the fact that you had opportunities that nobody else could get? You know what I'm saying? Like, how many people are millionaires because like you just are in the right city, the right connections, and the right position? Nothing to do with your talent.
Right place at the right time. Right. Yeah. Like I was reading, Elizabeth Yin was writing about micro investing, micro angel investing. She had a really good tweet storm about this just this week. And she was saying how that there are people who invested $5,000 in Uber that if they had never sold it, like in that angel round, would be worth $1 billion.
That's crazy. That's insane. That's insane. But I mean, I don't begrudge those people because Uber then wasn't the Uber that it was going to be, right? I'm talking about a company now that's clearly going to go public one day. It's clearly going to be worth a whole bunch of money. It's obvious. And the only impediment for me and you to get involved is just because we ain't got access. Like if you came to...
Would you have invested in Stripe though? Would you have invested in Stripe? If like what, Patrick and John were just like, hey, Mike, we're two brothers from Ireland and we want to like, revolutionize payments and we're going to do it through this simple API. And like, we want to build like, you know, something that's going to be easier for developers and all this kind of stuff. Would you have been like, yeah, okay. Because you used PayPal for a long time. Like you weren't even using Stripe when you could use Stripe.
Forgive me, Father, for I knew not why I did. No, basically, there's a funny story actually from their YC batch. Like investors were going around looking at all of the companies in their batch, right? Thinking, who should I invest in? And they were all using the Stripe plugin. So the investors would be like, oh, what's that thing that you're using for your little, you know, SaaS app that no one's ever going to hear of ever again? And they're like, oh, this is this great thing called Stripe. So these poor founders are thinking, oh, they're showing love to my company. But really, they were noticing the trend that everyone here is using Stripe. So if I was in that room, maybe I would have sniffed out and realized, actually, you know what?
As we have worked out, you would not have been in that room.
Yeah, that's the problem. And that's the damn problem. Do you know what I'm saying? Why don't they like me? I don't know. But the thing is, I would also say is that as a, you know, reformed former developer, I don't code full time, but I am a developer of some sorts. Getting credit card checkout payments was a hassle. Like that was the one thing where we were building apps and we were like, this is beyond my scope. This is like Amazon's competitive advantage, right? There wasn't an easy plug and play thing. So maybe I would have seen it, but maybe, you know, there's too many factors. I'd have to have the money. I'd have to be in the room. It never would happen. Right. And I think obviously shout out to people like Arlen and people that do stuff with, crowdsource investments that kind of try to democratize that space, right? And that's the main issue. But yeah, shout out to Stripe and the Collison brothers. They're basically billionaires now. They're gonna.
I interviewed at Stripe. I'm thinking about that equity I could have had. Bam. So there was like a time where I worked in the payments world when I was at Amazon, and I was like, nah, I'm not really feeling Amazon's vibe. And my homie was like, yo, yeah, come interview at Stripe. I got flown out to SF. because, you know, that VC money pops. Like, literally flew me out for an interview. And I remember it was really interesting because I was going for an account manager role, but they still wanted me to write JavaScript.
Wow.
Like, one part of the interview was just like, oh, like, this is like a, you know, line of code that we use in our payments. Like, what do you think comes next? Or like, what would you, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's so weird. But they obviously just wanted to, like, you know, make you feel uncomfortable or like test that or whatever. Anyway, I didn't get the job. Boohoo. I could have had some lovely little Stripe equity. But if I got that job, I probably wouldn't have started Hustle Crew. So, you know, it all works out in the end.
Yeah, it's funny. I think your stories of just like missed equity and missed out, like, it's like you basically are a billionaire in a previous life because you dropped out of Amazon and they were offering you some mad shares. You're like, no, I hate this company. I'm leaving.
That would have been like $250,000. Like, there's a parallel universe where I like stayed in all these jobs and I'm just like a black Warren Buffett.
Like, you took all your Amazon equity and you put it to Dogecoin and now you own like a country, basically. Yeah, you know what, it's there are a lot of people that are doing that thing in the valley where they're just going from company to company and just picking up the right equity over, like, you know, maybe you do a year at each place or 18 months, 2 years, and then by the end of 10 years you've got Amazon, Facebook, Stripe, you know, Uber all up in your
own. Would you have stayed at Coinbase for the IPO just to get that juice even after the announcement of like, don't bring your politics into work, leave BLM outside, like, for the for the sacrifice you had made? If you were that kind of person where you're like, let me just maximize my equity, maximize my earnings, would you have stayed?
You know what, I probably would have. I'm gonna keep it real because I think I would be like, I've suffered already, let me get the payday and then leave. Like, what's the point in like suffering and then not getting the reward? You might as well just suffer a bit more, get the payday, and then leave, right? Because the thing about that Coinbase story is that obviously I don't think a culture becomes, you know, toxic overnight. It obviously probably was problems at the company for a while. Probably black employees probably had complaints for a long time, right? And I think the kind of say BLM, you know, thing was the crux, was the kind of tipping point.
Yeah.
So if I was at a company where I was like, I don't agree with the culture here, but we're about a couple of weeks away from getting a massive payday.
No, I'm too emotional.
Seriously.
I'd be like, F this, I'm out. Mic drop, put my laptop, give all the swag away, put it on a freaking mass fire, set it alight. But
I'd be like, I would advise you, I'd be like, just take the money and run, and then take the money and put it to causes that you believe in. I just, but you're probably right though. I don't think your decision would be the emotional one. I think your one would be the principled one, to be honest. But I'm just being honest.
I'm just a better person.
I could just imagine me looking my mum in the eye and be like, yeah, so they were going to give me like $1 million, but I, you know, I don't like them, so I'm leaving. She'd be like, you fool. You think I came all the way in this country for you to do that? I'd be like, anyways, but I support the people that did step down and leave. I really appreciate what they did, in all seriousness. So while you were away, I tried to hold down the fort and I discussed the situation with Nigeria, the Nigerian government and Twitter. And basically, I was obviously thinking to myself, I wish Abba was here basically to kind of give me the full rundown. You're here now. So
I'm back.
You're back. So what was happening on the ground in terms of Twitter being banned, situation?
Yeah,
with the president?
I just thought I ran out of data. I'm not going to lie. I was like trying to get on Twitter and I was like, why won't my tweets load? I was like, this is so weird. Every other app was working. And I was like, this is so crazy. And then I was like, oh man, Twitter's banned. Okay. But it's weird because I'm not actually sure. And I would love to hear, maybe from like an engineering perspective, the logistics of websites being banned. Because I also remember the only other time this has happened to me was when I went to Beijing in 2018. And I couldn't get on Twitter. And I had to use a VPN on my laptop to get on Twitter. I didn't have a VPN on my phone, so I couldn't access the app. But yeah, there were a few times on certain connections where I actually could get on Twitter.
Right.
So for example, like I couldn't get on into my hotel, but I was out there because my dad wasn't very well. And there were times in the hospital where I could get on the Wi-Fi and get on Twitter there. So I don't really know like how banning a website works in countries and if it is something that is consistent.
I'm not sure how they
do that.
I don't know. I think they just talk to the talk to the service providers and say just block traffic from this one specific website and that's it.
Like this IP.
Yeah, basically. And that's it. There might be something more to it. But we've got to be careful actually when we say like, oh, I went to this country and I used a VPN because we may never be able to get back into that country again.
Did I say that?
Said about China. You might not be able to get back in, bro.
Using a VPN there. I was told if I used a VPN,
okay.
I could use it, but
cool.
I wanted to honor the authority.
No dry snitching here. No dry snitching on Tekish. Anyways, sorry, carry on.
But yeah, it's a crazy situation. I mean, I feel like I feel like there's like a really weird tension happening between social media and like political authority right now. And, you know, this isn't like the beginning of it. Like you said yourself in the solo episode, this is a trend that we've seen for a while. And, you know, we can think of like the last US president and all the nonsense that he caused on this platform. And, you know, Twitter played a pivotal role in like the end SARS movement that we saw unfolding over the last few months. And it's still an ongoing issue in Nigeria. It's a shame, I think, that such an authoritarian stance has been taken. But at the same time, that's what this president is known for. You know, it's not his first time in power. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people wanted Buhari to come back because they were like, we need a strong leader. We need a strong authoritative leader. But it's maybe like a misunderstanding of the complexity of the problem and why these issues persist. But yeah. Anyway, that's a more of a philosophical perspective on leadership.
Yeah, interesting. Let me ask you this, actually. So I found a tweet from quite a prominent Nigerian tweeter who I follow. And he said along the lines, Jack Dorsey has done more to advance the cause of freedom of expression, democracy and human rights in Nigeria over the past 6 years than any US diplomat and policymaker and any other US president, Obama, Trump and Biden inclusive. This is my context and reality as a Nigerian. So I'm guessing the backdrop is obviously the fact that he supported the NSARS movement, the fact that he's trying to promote kind of free expression in Nigeria. He's big on Bitcoin as well in the African context also. What say you? Is there any validity to what the statement is?
Wow. I mean, you know, it's important for me to call out my diaspora life because the truth is I don't spend as much time in Nigeria as a lot of people who are listening to this show. But I do think it is really hard in Nigeria, you know, especially like, you know, Nigeria is one of those societies where like the more privilege you have, the more power and authority you have. Mm. And a lot of people do not have privilege by virtue of their age, their status, their background, their education. And, you know, what you often see in that society is the elite. And there is like a very strong, entrenched elite. Mm. In Nigeria are the ones that occupy the headlines, dominate the airwaves, and they're the ones that get to tell their stories. Right. And there are like a few channels, whether that's radio or other things, where other voices, marginalized voices, get to speak up. But I think Twitter has been transformative. And I think, you know, things like the NSARS movement couldn't have reached that critical mass and then gotten that international exposure if platforms like Twitter didn't exist. Right. So I agree with this.
Interesting. Cool. Okay, so the world has changed for better or for worse.
And has it?
Yes. So so basically now a lot of tech companies are trying to figure out what is their policy on remote work, flexible work, hybrid model, yada, yada, yada. And like the FAANG companies have got differing policies. So Apple is now doing 3 days in office, 2 days from home. There was like an employee like petition / letter that was sent to the Apple HQ saying, listen, we don't really want to go back, basically, right? And I think Apple initially was meant to be like, we're all coming back. And I think this is meant to be the compromise. Google is doing something similar to Apple, 3 days in, 2 days off. Facebook is remote for all levels. And Amazon, which was originally also going to be completely in office, is now looking at the hybrid model. What say you? What do you think is the optimal model? What would you prefer as an employee? B, there has been some murmurs of people saying, if you're young and you're up and coming, maybe you're going to miss out on opportunities because you're not in the office. What do you think about this whole situation?
That second point is like so overrated. Like I spent so much of my career in an office where I was basically like having my butt pinched or being ignored or having my hair touched without my permission. Like, I don't know if I gained anything from those experiences. Like, don't get me wrong. I've made like friends for life, but I also could have just like the friendship was formed not in the office. It was like the choice we made to hang out on the weekend or the choice we made to go out and watch a movie together and grab dinner. And like, yes, of course, having those experiences of overcoming challenges together does bond you. But at the same time, I think of my time at Product Hunt where I worked remotely for 3 years. And those are some of my best friends in tech today, you know what I mean?
Right.
And we didn't need to be in an office together to form those connections. So on that second point where people are like, oh, young people are missing out, like that to me is just that mindset of like not understanding what they gain by this experience.
Right.
Like when you apply the lens of your experience to a situation, it's very easy to see like what is lost. But if you zoom out or acknowledge that you don't know everything, then what you don't realize is there's actually more opportunity to be gained. Like it's easier to have a side hustle now. It's easier to live the life that adapts to your experiences and your needs in a way that couldn't before because you don't need to come into the office. You know, if you have dependents at home or any special needs, it's now easier for you to be a part of that environment. And it's probably a more equitable environment because everyone's, you know, working from home. So I think that second point really doesn't stand. And then on that first point, you know, what do I think is the ideal situation? I'll start from the economics of it and then I'll come down to my personal point of view. Bloomberg did an amazing analysis specifically on the US and the fact that there is a labor shortage in the US, especially in qualified roles, especially in industries like technology. It is an employee's market for that reason, right. not an employer's market. And people are quitting if they are not getting the flexibility that they need because there are choices out there. Yep. And, you know, this is a reminder to all of you listening to this show. If you don't like what your employer is offering you, you can have the choice of leaving. And I'm seeing this in my company. You know, we're losing a lot of people in Brandwatch since, you know, the deal, but we're also gaining a lot of people, right? Like, we got new joiners joining all the time. Like, there's a lot of movement happening right now. Like, workers are going where they want to be happier, where they think they'll be happier. And I think it's really important for people to, you know, if I were a leader right now, I would be asking this question: why do we want people here? Mm-hmm. Is it to make us feel better about the cost of the investment that we've made in this office? Is it to make us feel better about the fact that we can't break this lease? Because maybe we should just get a lawyer involved and try and break this lease yeah. and regain some of the costs and, like, you know, admit whatever is sunk and lost. Is it because we can't trust people unless we see them? Because then that is a much bigger issue that you need to start thinking about what is wrong in your culture. On a personal level, I've always believed you don't manage teams, you manage individuals, mm-hmm. and you need to respond to what individuals need. And what individuals are saying is that they value flexibility. I'm obsessed with equity. I'm obsessed with inclusion. I know that remote work has made the workplace more equitable. It just has. Mm. From the fact that it's been easier for people who are more introverted to take up space in meetings, pardon me, to the fact that people with disabilities or like children have been able to bring more of their whole selves into work because they can work from home. I just feel like the benefits, pardon me, are endless. So why do we want to let them go? What are your thoughts?
I pretty much agree with everything you've said. I think we had beforehand like this one size fits all model and it was complete nonsense. I've always like loved remote work and I've been a remote worker for as long as I could possibly be. And if I,
because
I hate people, I hate you too. I'm gonna play. what would I want if, because obviously as an, I'm an employer now. Let's say I worked at like a tech company that was super large. What would I prefer? It depends what stage of life I'm at, honestly. If I was like in my early 20s, probably fresh out of uni, I think that juxtaposition of university and then straight into just sitting at home, just coding, I probably would have liked a bit more social interaction. But I think for the vast majority of time, remote work for the win. And you're right. I think these companies...
All the people that want to go into the office are just frigging dilly-dallyers on busybody people. But hold on.
Let me land on this one. But I do think that is a part of being human, though. Like, chatting to people is a...
Yeah, but then do it on your own time. I'm trying to get my shit done.
And that's why you are a VP, because you made it to the top, because you're about that
no,
work.
Like, for real.
Yeah, no.
Like, you want me to come into the office for what? So you can come gossip, do this, that, the other? I got projects to complete, y'all.
Yeah. No, listen, I respect that. I think that's actually the right way to be. But I don't think we can sit there and say that that's not a human need. People do have a need. They wanna get to know the people they work with. They wanna chit-chat. And you're right. Maybe work has become too much of our lives. And that actually we need to make space to have lives outside of work. And this is one step towards that. And it might take a bit of adjustment, right? But I think...
So you know what? All I was going to say is like, so at Brandwatch, like, you know, we've been trying to do our best to just like adapt. Yeah. So Tara, who's on my team, you actually met her when we went to Philly for Project North Star.
Okay, all right,
cool. Yeah, she was there. But anyway, so that was at Black and Brown Founders event. Shout out Black and Brown Founders. Yep. But anyway, one of the things that she... looked into very early on was getting WeWork global passes. Because mm-hmm. she was like, if we're going to shut our offices because they're a cost liability that we want to reduce, but there are people that have said they need to get out of the house, they need to meet up with other people, why don't we look into like WeWork global passes? And all the co-working spaces are offering this now. It's super cost effective. You can give people a pass that lets them go into any office. And then everyone in like, I don't know, Flatiron, New York or Williamsburg can be like, hey, yeah. let's all go into the office Wednesday, Friday or whatever. Like there's so many ways for companies to adapt and be flexible. And the ones that are like, you have to do this, you have to do that, are just lacking in creativity.
Yeah, you know what? I think, I don't know. I have a bit more of a nuanced take on this because I think it works for 90% of companies, this remote work hybrid model. But I'm not sure if the iPhone could be made by a straight up remote team. I do feel, I understand why Apple and their DNA is like, we need to be in the office because how do we make an iPod or an iPhone or an iPad, hardware, software, something that's so much in touch with the consumer experience, but 99.9% of companies, I struggle to have the creativity to imagine that.
Because it's hardware. You're saying that like a physical thing needs to be collaborated on.
Well, not just hardware. For example, the iPhone is such a definitive phone that every phone is basically an iPhone. Like if you've got a Samsung or an Android, it's basically an iPhone. And before iPhone, there was...
Not a BlackBerry.
Yeah, a BlackBerry's bust. They're gone. Because they, you know what I'm saying? Like everyone, every...
I miss BlackBerries. Anyway, go on.
No, the point I'm making is that like there are certain product defining, there's certain company defining products that I struggle to imagine they could be done as world in a remote first world. But 99...
Well, let's see.
99.9% of companies are not Apple. 99.9% of companies are not working on anything as revolutionary as the iPhone. Most of you are working on software, and if you're working in tech, and you can do that all completely remote. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm anti-remote. I'm completely pro-remote and completely pro... I'm not even sure if the hybrid is even the best thing, but I'm pro whatever, anyone, experimentation. But yeah, I like the whole thing about worker power. I think part of the reason why FAANG companies are doing all this remote stuff now is because they realize that their employees can up and leave and get a better deal elsewhere. And like, if I'm an Amazon software engineer, I can just be like, well, if you're not giving me remote, I'm going, B, I can start.
Like, imagine you're like a senior data scientist, senior product designer, and you're asking to work from home, and they're just like, no, we're not going to allow it. I'd literally be like, bye-bye then.
Yeah. So power to the people. Shout out to them.
They will have to drag me to that office kicking and screaming. My boss is listening. You heard it here first.
This episode is sponsored by Fly.io. Fly.io lets you deploy servers close to your users, letting you run your full stack apps and databases all over the world. No ops required. They are hiring on Pocket Jobs for a site reliability engineer. The position is remote, and the link to apply is in the show notes.
Yo, so Mike.
Yo.
I was going to ask you a favor. Mm-hmm. If I could just borrow $28 million off of you, because I want to get a seat on Jeff's space.
I am doing the wire transfer as we speak. Yeah. I mean, if you want to die, there's easier ways, bro. That's what I'm going
to
say.
But, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, let's not joke around, a lot of people listening to this show are excited about going to space. Mm-hmm. I know you. This is one of my favorite dinner party questions where I'm just like, if you had a chance to like fly to Mars, but there was no guarantee you could come back, would you do it? And whenever I ask that question at like techie dinner parties, at least half the table are like, oh my God, of course I would. It's Mars. Imagine being the first human to step foot. I was like, what, on a red fucking desert rock? Like, anyway, I obviously don't have enough of that pioneer mindset. But as we all know, Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' space company, is getting ready to gear up for its first, what would you even call it? Luxury space flight? Is it all first class or is there economy?
I don't know what it is, but it's Blue Origin's first human space flight. I haven't seen...
Do you get a free meal?
I don't... I don't
want them to do that Delta thing where you got to pay for your...
From what I've seen of Blue Origin's rockets and SpaceX rockets, it's like quite a austere just rocket. It ain't no like... It's not looking like a plane, basically.
No free meal.
It's economy.
Do they show no movies?
No movies, nothing. So what do you think?
Glass of champagne on arrival?
On my last show, I basically said that I feel like he's going for a midlife crisis, because why would he be crazy enough to want to be the first human space with his brother as well?
On the day he's going to have a tummy bug or like COVID or something. Yeah. This is all hype.
You don't think he's going to do it?
He's not going to do it. I would literally bet you £100 right now that he doesn't end up doing it. Do you want to take that bet?
You're too rich for me. I can't do that. But I will...
£10.
Okay, £10 will do. Okay,
ten Dogecoins.
That's a good Nando's meal. £10-ish. But the...
I'll bet you a Nando's.
Yeah, you know what? I hope there is a happy ending to this story. I hope he probably doesn't go through with it, or he does it and lands safely.
What is your happy ending, though? Because, like, honestly, I don't want to say what mine would be.
Oh, no. My happy ending is that he survived. So I don't want to turn on the news and see Jeff Bezos blow up on TV.
Challenger 86.
No. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, we don't want
that.
No,
we definitely don't want that. I also think this is what happens when you're too rich. You got too many yes people around you, and like no one's around you saying, what the hell are you thinking? Yeah, what the hell are you thinking? Like, you are the richest man on earth, pretty much. Life is so good for you. You are better.
There are bigger problems to solve, Jeff. There are bigger problems to solve. Come give clean water. And I just came back from Nigeria. Come give us some clean water. Come help us have a look. If we have a better electricity supply and better internet, we can buy more Amazon stuff. Come give us better infrastructure, man. Like, there's better problems to solve than space. Like, there's a toxic masculinity in the current private space race that leaves a bad taste in my mouth, as I've spoken about before, between Jeff and Elon and their friggin' giant metal penises flying through the sky. Oh, come on.
Did you see what it's
so basic.
When Blue Origin's rocket failed to launch, Elon tweeted, oh, you can't get it up, Jeff. What's going on? So there's definitely a lot of undertones. There's a lot of homoerotic undertones going on between these two. But I mean,
they're probably best friends, though.
I don't know. I think the egos on those two wouldn't allow them to be best friends with.
Really?
I don't even know if you...
No, I thought billionaires like to? I thought they were all like in the Illuminati, planning the demise of the human.
Nah, I doubt it. I don't think you could even have a best friend when you're that rich, to be honest. I think, yeah, anyways.
You gotta buy your best friend.
You gotta buy them, you know what I mean? Anyway, sure.
Who's on Friday? Best friend number two starts at 8.
The rotation. All right, cool. We'll see. So I want.
Okay, if you got a free ticket, would you go?
No, absolutely not. It's way too risky.
Not even if it was free. No. Okay, what if the people on it were like Warren Buffett?
Don't care. I don't care who's on there. I'm not going on this. So what, we could all die together and hold hands and I could, my bragging rights, my bragging rights. I went to heaven with Jay-Z. Is that my bragging rights? No way.
But how do you know? You don't know they're going to die. You don't know they're going to die.
The risk is too high for me. I think
that guy, the Red Bull guy, freaking flew from the atmosphere and like he survived.
I'm not about this life. I think if you said to me, guarantee safety, guaranteed, absolutely, there's no, like, it's 100% success rate.
You're more likely to die in a car crash than in a Blue Origin space flight.
No, that's still not enough.
Statistically.
You know what it is? You know, you said you don't have that pioneering mindset. I also think we just don't have that colonizer DNA in us, man. I just don't have that. I don't have that incentive to be like, I'm
not that reparations DNA. I'm just like, nah.
I don't have that incentive to be like, I'm the first one here. Like, and oh my God, look at me. I made it. Like, that's not me.
I'm just trying to be the last one alive, you know what I'm saying? Like, hey, survivor mode.
You know what? So this story here coming up is slightly intriguing. So article in the Wall Street Journal about something that's been going on for quite some time, but it's kind of blown up just based off this article. And it's titled, "If you sell a house these days, the buyer might be a pension fund." So what's been going on? People are studying and realizing that pension funds like BlackRock are outbidding average people, home buyers, by 20-30%, and trying to scoop up as much assets as possible, basically. And I sourced this from Reddit, so I don't know how true it is, but when I looked at the Reddit forum about this post, someone said how the Taiwanese pension funds have got like $300 billion worth of US real estate as well. So it's another kind of attack vector on the kind of aspirations of the average person in the Western societies, because it's like, really and truly, how else do you build wealth? We could talk about stocks, but the average person builds their wealth for property, you know. They don't rent, they buy the house, they put a down payment, and then they sell the house when they're older and they can retire, right? I mean, obviously there's a lot of impediments to home buying, so it's not like everyone can do it, you know what I'm saying? But generally speaking, that was a roadmap that was at least kind of viable, depending on what city you lived in. Okay, London, probably not. New York, probably not. San Francisco, probably not, right? In many areas, it was. So the fact that this is now being scooped up by permanent capital, and it's now being scooped up by faceless institutions who, if you're their landlord, are they really going to get back to your email? Can you really, like, you know, like, if you got a landlord, most landlords are, you know, quite cruel, to be honest. But if you got a landlord and like there's an issue of, you know, you can't pay a rent or whatever, right? I would much rather try to speech a person than try to speech BlackRock, because BlackRock has no humanity. Yeah. BlackRock, I can't look BlackRock.
They will outsource it to an agency. They're going to like start their own like property management division. I mean, like, I think that's really interesting because I just recently rewatched like The Big Short.
Great film.
Which was all about how the housing market completely collapsed. Such a good film. And, you know, that overheated property market that ended up being like one of the worst ever fucking bubbles and like all this nonsense and no one went to jail for it. Let me not even go down that tangent. But anyway, in a way, it is a reminder of that like very old, what's that famous quote that's like, buy land because they're running out of
it. Yeah, you got it right. Yeah, you got it right, basically. That's the quote.
And I was just like, okay, yeah, it's obviously like annoying that pension funds or financial institutions are basically like, oh, let me prop up, they want to prop up their portfolio with property. But it's maybe just like another reminder to all of us who are like getting caught up in the crypto wave and this, that, and the other that, like, you know, if we are being serious about diversifying our portfolio, let's not undervalue property. Because, you know, this is one of the things that's like I see as like millennial investors and younger investors. People don't want to buy a home. They want to like stay at home as long as they can, stay with their parents. They want to be like locked in with a mortgage. They don't even know where they're going to live. Maybe they're going to be a nomad. They're going to be this. They're going to be that or the other. And it's like, okay, like I get that there are like cultural reasons why you don't want to be pinned down with a mortgage and you don't want to have a home. But if you're serious about investing, then like free and invest in property, because like if the pension funds are doing it, like, you know that there's some analysis and modeling that's going behind that's making that a good bet, a good call. And like your concerns, which I like think are totally valid, are mitigated by the fact that BlackRock is not going to be your landlord. Like, they're going to go into a partnership with, like, I don't know, whatever Foxton's is in the US and things like that, and then they will be the managers of the property.
But, you know, with Coinbase and crypto and all that stuff, like, what is the kind of entry fee? You could start with $100. The part of the reason why millennials love like these crypto and stuff like that and Gen Z is just because the low barrier to entry.
Yeah, right.
Buying a property, bro, you need at least like 50,000, 60,000, 70,000, 100,000. You got to have a bank look you in the eye and approve you.
But why don't people pull together? Why don't people pull together? Like, look, banks that are listening to this, like, be creative with the financial instruments that you offer. Like, you need a new type of mortgage that makes it easier for 10, 15, 20 friends to come together with multiple pockets of cash, form and pool a deposit, whatever, work out the risks. But like, you know, mortgages have been the same for like hundreds of freaking years. Like, come on, banks, catch up with the progress. All of the innovation in financial products happens for investors that are like super, super high net worth. And it's just like, at the end of the day, if you pooled together the cash that's with like smaller individual consumers, it's still a significant amount of money. Like, I don't know why investment banks aren't innovating for us.
But the thing is, okay, that might be a fintech idea that someone could work on. And by the time it gets here, obviously the fuckery continues. But I don't know how, I don't know how it works really. I mean, you might pull together with five of your homies, but you all five can't live there. So maybe you're talking about as a landlord, fair enough. But like, realistically speaking, we're all attuned to the concept of, I grow up, I leave my parents' home, and maybe one day I can buy an affordable house and raise a family with my partner or whatever, right? And that dream is getting further and further away, especially if you're living in one of these kind of, you know, dense cities. I don't know what the answer is. And even if you do get that mortgage with your five friends, BlackRock is outbidding you by 20 to 30, 50%. So it's like, you're screwed. I mean, listen, it's not completely doom and gloom. It's still possible to get a house if you have the right credentials and the right deposit. I'm sure, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I feel like the system is fucking people in so many different ways. It's like, you can't invest in startups because you're not an accredited investor. You can't buy property now because you're, you know, I mean, you can, but it's getting harder to buy property because of things like BlackRock, right? And then we sit there and wonder why people are like, yo, we got to burn the system down. Like, at least give people a chance to partake in capitalism. If we're going to have capitalism, let people partake in it. Do you know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a interesting story, and I think something to keep abreast of, really.
Okay, Techish fans, that brings us to the end of another episode. Are you following us at Techish Pod on Instagram, on Twitter? Because some of you, I see you, you're not. So you need to get on there and follow us. And have you reviewed us recently on Apple Podcasts? Because some of you, again, I see you, you have not. So get on there, give us 5 stars, and tell us why you love us. And we will see you again next week.
Ciao, peace.
Bye.